This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last weekend, I climbed a mountain with one of my kiddos, Mount Monadnock in the great state of New Hampshire. So we're not talking about high-altitude alpine mountaineering here. More like a very doable up-and-down day trip, but with some really fun rocky scrambles, some sheer granite cliffs, and a view from the top that makes it worth the effort. You know, the lakes and forests and even the minuscule skyline of the city we left behind far away on the far, far horizon. That kind of view. But anyway, this story is not about the climb up or the magnificent view from the top. This is a story about the way down. Because yours truly is just not in the same sinewy and lithe shape I was several decades ago. So on the way down, I had the constant company of my creaking joints and complaining muscles, along with the company of my 7-year-old son. And he admitted that he, too, had a case of what we called spaghetti legs because he wasn't feeling his strongest. We'd done a lot of side trails on the way up and really taken our time, so it'd been a long day. On the way down, we were both feeling kind of whiny. So we sat and surveyed the situation. We made a list of our options, and they were rather simple, right? We could head back up, which we agreed would accomplish nothing except for maybe an unplanned night on a hard granite slab. We could sit where we were and let the bugs feast. Or we could keep lumbering down. So we opted for down. And then something wonderful happened. I watched my son loosen up and let go. He wasn't hiking down the mountain so much as all of a sudden just flowing down it. He started singing a made-up song, something about the contrails made by the airplanes overhead and mixing that up with cars and rocks and stars. I couldn't quite hear it all through my own frequent oof and groans every time my knees hit the granite. And by the way, my son was getting farther and farther ahead of me anyway as he was, as I said, flowing down the mountain. But it was clear to me that he was, in fact, somewhere else, somewhere beautiful, on an internal journey to another place. But that internal journey happened only because he was out there, skipping and scrambling over rocks on a New Hampshire mountain with his mother somewhere far behind him. Now, I wanted to share that story with you today because we've got a terrific guest on the show, Stephen Rinella. He's the host of the Netflix series Meat Eater and the Meat Eater podcast, and he has many books on wildlife, hunting, fishing, game cooking, and a new one out. This book is called Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, Getting Your Family Out of the House and Radically Engaged with Nature. And given the fact that we are heading deep into summer, we thought it was the perfect day to have a conversation with Stephen. And he joins us from Bozeman, Montana. Stephen Rinella, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the chance.
You know, I know you've experienced that same thing about watching your kids sort of, in a sense, be so completely in the place they are when they're out in nature that it almost feels like they're somewhere else. Do you know what I mean when I said that?
Oh, yeah. Somewhere else being not inside, yeah. Asking me if they can mess with their iPad. Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. And then to see them get lost in it and forget about the other things and find a inner toughness, right?
Yeah.
And a perseverance to go and do something. Yeah, it's wonderful. I've been chasing that feeling for 12 years because my oldest kid is 12 years old.
Yeah. So tell us about that. I want to get to some of the specifics you write about in your book, which, by the way, is not just for parents. It's for anyone who considers themselves an older mentor of a child. But talk about, I don't know, some of your experiences with your kids. Let's start with one that might be more familiar to folks, like camping in Yellowstone.
Well, you counting that as familiar?
Well, just some of us, maybe. Sorry.
Well, first I would point out that even though I live in Montana now and I grew up in a very rural, like nature perfect environment, my first two kids were born in Brooklyn, New York. My third kid was born in Seattle. So I have, you know, through the course of my life, lived a lot of like very perfect, pristine wilderness moments. But having young kids, I knew that they weren't all gonna, they weren't gonna be that way, right? I felt a lot of frustration raising kids in an urban environment, and I felt frustration and guilt that I wasn't able to give them these kind of like amazing moments that would be once in a lifetime trips for people that I've been able to go on many of. And so I had to learn to find find pleasure and contentment in what I viewed at the time to be kind of a compromised version of nature, which is the urban nature. Mm-hmm. So if I was going to point to more, I don't want to call them mundane, but like simpler to achieve moments, it would just be the time that we spent even in Brooklyn and in many other places, at their grandparents' houses, whatever, the time we spent flipping rocks and rolling over rotten logs and watching what scurries out of the way, and them holding roly-polies and them holding worms and various grubs and doing what I thought to be the step one is getting them over the idea that there's nothing icky or gross anywhere. Right? Those words don't belong in our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And that we spent a lot of time on that, and it was very rewarding and caused me to like look and find out what things are, you know?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I hear you about Brooklyn and Seattle. And in fact, we're going to talk more in the show a bit later about how to be radically engaged, as you say in the subtitle of your book, with nature, no matter where you are. But I am curious if you could tell us a story about the first camping trip that you went on as a family with your kids.
Yeah, the first camping trip we went on that was, whereas, you know, five of us, right? So the full family complete, tent camping. We were in the... not too far from Yellowstone Park. We're in the Yellowstone Basin, but out more out on the Great Plains. And we were going for Easter. So it was early, and took the kids out. And there was the primary concern that we had going into it was that whether or not, like how the Easter Bunny would locate us out camping. I had for them a story about camping with my own family in the Smoky Mountains. And I was saying the Easter Bunny found us in a very remote location. So, you know, this, we debated whether the Easter Bunny is male or female. But what we hadn't really reckoned on was just nonstop rain and wet snow. And out there they have everybody calls it gumbo. It's like an expandable clay. The soil is an expandable clay. And when it rains, it goes from sort of a hard packed ground to just the most tenacious mud you can imagine, where I point out that it's like somehow manages to be sticky and slimy at the same time. And when you're in it, I mean, when you brush your teeth at night, it's like it gets in, it somehow finds its way into your toothbrush. And we got to the point where everybody's soaked, everything in the tent's covered in mud. But weirdly, the only ones who were miserable were my wife and I. The kids were fine. We quit early. I felt just like this devastating guilt. I never quit. I don't like to quit anything early. I don't like to go home. I felt like we had just been defeated by this camping trip. But the kids came away with it, that it was this tremendous victory. They had found a scorpion that I didn't know existed. I told them there's zero scorpions in Montana. We argued about it. They proved me wrong with an actual physical specimen of a northern scorpion. They found some ochre, which Native American cultures would use as a dye, and they would use it as face paint. they independently figured out that they should paint their faces with ochre, which was a totally cool discovery. Yeah. They rolled rocks down the hill, and I would yell at them about doing that. And they had this fantastic time. And I realized that, like, it was kind of an important moment for me, because I realized their definition of success and their definition of fun doesn't necessarily line up with my own. Like, I view it like that things were orderly, that everybody still got to bed on time, that we had a good plan for dirty clothes and how to keep pajamas clean. They didn't care about any of that. Like, their program, their mental journey is so completely different, I'll say, than my own, than our own, as caregivers often. And it's like you have to just remind yourself almost on a minute-to-minute basis to try to assess situations based on what they're getting rather than what your preconceived notion of what outdoor experiences should look and feel like.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. Because funnily enough, it was actually at Yellowstone where I had a similar experience where we got out of the vehicle at one of our campsites. And the first thing my kids did is they made a beeline to the fire pit and just like grabbed the charcoal from the last camper's fire, which fortunately it wasn't hot, but like they grabbed it and just started like putting it all over their faces and painting their faces with it. And they were like off and running from that point on. We didn't even actually have to go very far in the park. We did, but they were happy enough as it was, just entering a nature and kids zone, which I think part of the point of your book is trying to find ways to do that. And you don't have to necessarily go out into America's Great Western Wild, but we're going to talk more about how. So Stephen Ranella is with us today. His new book is Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, Getting Your Family Out of the House and Radically Engaged with Nature. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Stephen Ranella is our guest today. He's the host of the Netflix series Meat Eater and the Meat Eater podcast as well. And he has a new book out. It's called Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, Getting Your Family Out of the House and Radically Engaged with Nature. Stephen, can I just first ask you to tell us a little bit more about sort of your growing up? Because there was a lot, you said, a lot of outdoor time, almost sort of built into your very existence from the start.
Yeah, but my parents, they had it set up where they didn't seem to fret about it quite like we do today. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Western Michigan on a lake, right? So my parents originally had grown up in the greater Chicago area. My dad had me, he was quite old. So he was born in 1924 and actually fought in World War II. And in the years following that, moved his family up 4 hours north of Chicago into Michigan, which was then, you know, it was like the Great North, right? And we had neighbors probably, I don't know, I mean, maybe 30 or we had a neighbor's house, maybe 30 or 40 yards from our front door. But we had a big yard and we had a lake and there was woods all around us. And it was just, we were outside all the time. I mean, we defined ourselves as hunters and anglers and outdoors people. And we were just kicked out of the house. And it was funny, the enforcement of it was strange because if my dad caught you inside, like watching TV, he would generate for you this like a chore list that couldn't be conquered. He had these legal pads and he would just start listing chores till he got to the bottom of the page on each line. And I don't know, it was like he'd come up with 26 chores. And so if you were outside though, he never ever messed with you. And it was like that was how they did it. And now and then I look back now and I wonder, were they like the risks we took and the danger we courted, were they indifferent to it, just didn't care, it didn't occur to them? Or were they, yes, the things they're engaged with could be viewed as dangerous, but we've made this calculated decision to let the kids go and do that in order that they will be self-sufficient, in order that they will not be risk averse, in order that they will be comfortable being uncomfortable. Like, I don't know. And when I ask my mom about this now, she isn't really able to answer it because it's just not her vocabulary.
Yeah.
Right. The questions I'm asking aren't things that occurred to her at the time, which makes me think that they just somehow innately knew that us being outside was good, and they felt that us being inside was not good.
Mm. What were the risks, though, specifically, that looking back, you were taking?
Many. I spend a lot of time calculating risk now for my own kids. And one risk that I don't think is overblown is water. Okay. So
yeah.
the risk of drowning. We had many boats. And when I say boats, I mean like canoes and John boats, like just simple small watercraft that you might pick up at yard sales for $75 or free from a neighbor. We would just go. Our lake joined into other lakes. We would go out and even in, you know, elementary school, early middle school days, we would boat out and sleep on this little island that was out in a neighboring lake. So there, how did my folks deal with that? My dad would periodically just throw us off the end of the dock to see how well we'd get back in. Right. And it was when you could do that, if he could huck you off the dock and you'd get back in, then he was felt a little bit less risky. Like one of the earliest, like closest, what I would regard as a, I remember it sort of as a near death experience. We had this little catamaran sailboat. I remember I was very little. And we flipped it over. My older brother was maybe in seventh grade. I was in fourth or fifth grade. We flipped it over and I got trapped under the platform. And I remember him swimming down there and pulling me out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, you would like people, you'd hear of people drowning on a neighboring lake. And it was just a thing. So that sort of risk. We would also ride off into the woods to go hunting for squirrels. We, at a pretty young age, looking back, earlier than you were legally supposed to be able to, we would ride off in the woods with our 22s and ride off on bikes to go hunt squirrels. And these are things that I would be very nervous about with my own kids. We live and spend a lot of time. We just camped this weekend, for instance. We live and spend a lot of time in grizzly bear country.
Mm-hmm.
Some people look and they'd think that I was being irresponsible with my own kids about how we behave and what we do in grizzly country. But I've kind of run that analysis, so to speak, in my head. It's a legitimate risk, but I don't think it warrants paranoia, or as we like to call it, baranoia. Water makes me very nervous.
Yeah. No, so I'm going to just step in here because I think you're making a really important point. The risk calculus that caregivers or parents do today can and should be scrutinized, because I think we might overly inflate certain risks over others. But water, definitely a danger. I think people being more attentive to putting, you know, PFDs on kids and being sure their supervision of kids around water is very, very important. And it's an advancement that we've made over when you and I were kids, Stephen, because I know a lot of stories of kids drowning when I was growing up, too. And there's other kinds of risks. There are people who live in neighborhoods where just unfettered, unsupervised time outside actually is a safety danger for those kids, given, like, say, the amount of crime in their neighborhood. So I don't want to diminish those. But overall, it does seem as if parents and caregivers, even those of us, or maybe especially those of us who grew up with these sort of more free-ranging childhoods ourselves, have really changed in our own perception of what's risky or not for kids. So if we wanted to pinpoint where in time that shift may have begun, it might be the late 80s.
And so what happened then? What really came about in the late 80s was this model of parenting called intensive parenting. And what that means is really parents spending more time curating their children's lives and being concerned about, you know, what their children got up to and that sort of thing.
So that's Mariana Brusoni. She's a professor at the University of British Columbia who researches children's outdoor play, including its benefits and the barriers to that play. And Brusoni says, look to the recession of the early 1980s, one of the most severe since the Second World War. That downturn, she says, made parents concerned that their kids would not enjoy the same quality of life that they did.
So that means that parents becoming more concerned about their kids getting into the right schools, you know, so that they can then get into the right universities, so that they can then get the right careers and so on, right? And I'm speaking here, you know, it's a very middle class ideal, right? So it's not necessarily reflective of reality for all parents, but it's kind of the societal zeitgeist.
So unstructured outside time, free from direct adult supervision or interference. For many families, that quickly became a thing of the past. And at the same time, there were other shifts like
more urbanization, which has meant also a more car-dominated culture, which has meant less kind of play spaces for kids. And you've also seen an increase of women into the workforce. And so kind of less mothers being around in the neighborhood and keeping that informal eye on the kids. And then, you know, another factor is people are having less children. And so you have less siblings in a family. And we know that one of the factors of getting kids out is like, if kids have siblings, then parents are more inclined to say, just, you know, go out and play with your brother or go out and play with your sister.
Brusoni also says it's not just the time outside has been reduced for kids. It's that parents feel that it's not safe outside, even though that directly contradicts their own free-ranging childhood experiences.
They talk about remembering these kind of childhoods where they would just go out and play and kind of fighting with themselves a bit, like, that was really valuable for me. I got so much out of that. And yet the world is not a safe place. The world is not as innocent as it was when I was a child, when in fact the statistics don't. Like, it's never been a safer time, actually, to be a child.
And finally, Professor Brusoni says, parents, what we need to do, and caregivers, what we need to do is set aside the media's and society's bias towards massively inflating negative news.
What's helpful to let parents know is, you know, for example, that some of their fears really aren't justified, such as the injury statistics. And, you know, like they're so afraid that kids will get kidnapped, which is like, you know, every parent's worst nightmare. But in Canada, for example, the likelihood of kidnapping is by a stranger is 1 in 14 million, right? Like it's the same as winning our national lottery. It's vanishingly rare that actually happens. And yet we're placing all these constraints on our kids. So we can think about it as building our skills as well as building our children's skills.
That's Mariana Brusoni, professor at the University of British Columbia's Department of Pediatrics. She researches outdoor and risky play. Now, Stephen Ranello, the reason why we wanted to share Professor Brusoni's thoughts is I wonder if is one of the first steps to getting the whole family out of the house more is changing the mindset of the adults in the house? And if so, how do we do that?
That was fascinating to hear that clip, because it makes me realize that I was, I was born right at the right time, because I was born in the mid 70s. So I missed all that intensive parenting, which is nice. Years ago, I wrote a piece for Outside Magazine. It was called, they gave it some title, like The Little Things That Kill. But I was kind of reviewing, you know, a life of adventure and what are the things that had actually felled me? Okay. Like, what are the things that put me in the hospital? Related to the wild. And it turns out they're all microscopic. Okay. It's waterborne pathogens, insect-borne pathogens, Lyme's disease, okay, which my son and I both had. It's very important from overcoming the fear perspective is like getting statistical and getting comfortable with like what actually needs to be paid attention to. And then getting that taken care of, like trying to enter a rational space where you look and be like, here, the primary risk here is that the kids will get a tick and they'll get Lyme, right? And getting educated about it to the point where you're like, we are taking a rational, without getting too overblown, we're taking a rational approach here. We're using repellent. We're doing tick checks. we're tucking socks and we're tucking pant legs into socks, right? We're doing all these things and we've diminished, mitigated the risk. So then the next step is just trying to get comfortable. The other thing, like that's in perspective of risk. Another thing that I think is really important that I see a lot of parents miss is just getting to a attitude of that you're not going to take no for an answer. When it comes to outdoor time, when it comes to camping and hikes, my wife and I, we don't ask our kids if they want to go. We're going, right? We're going on this day. We give them a couple days heads up so they can plan it. And we're not asking their opinion about it. We don't ask their opinion about how far we're going to walk. When they hear us say it and we give them the time and we make plans to account for their comfort, that's what we're doing. Especially with young kids, when you get into like, oh, there's nap time and there's snacks and I don't want to bring the diaper bag and the 5-year-old doesn't need a nap or the 2-year-old does need a nap. And when it's all said and done, we're just not going to go. That happens. And I see it happen to people. And then that like lack of action just extends into years. And then you start forming a habit where you're not a family that's just going to go, right? I think that setting your mind that you will not take no, it doesn't matter the weather, it doesn't matter whatever, you're going. And I think it puts into your kids, I see it with mine, it puts into your kids where they become people of action, right? They're not wishy-washy. They become precise and specific about what they're going to get done no matter what gets in their way.
Yeah. You know, so not no matter what, you're going to go. I'm going to call that Stephen Rinella's first rule of getting out of the house, right?
And then, yeah, it's a metaphorical grabbing them by the ear.
So and then in the book, you also like, let's just sort of take the next step out of the house. So we're standing on the threshold of we're all metaphorically on our own front doors, looking around our own environments, home environments, whatever that might be. And in the first chapter of your book, Thinking Native, you actually offer a bunch of really, really interesting questions that I think show that you don't have to go very far to get, again, radically engaged with nature. I love the subtitle of your book, Radically Engaged. So I'm going to just take a second and read one of these questions. And I want everyone listening right now, just listen to the question and see if you can answer it about your own home environment. So Stephen Rinella in his book says, ask yourself this, what is the elevation of your home habitat? Almost 3/4 of the Earth is covered by our oceans, which are all connected. The highest point of land on Earth is Mount Everest at 29,029 feet above sea level. The lowest point of land on Earth, the shoreline of the Dead Sea, is actually 1,355 feet below sea level. So how far downhill, or uphill for that matter, from your doorstep is the ocean? What a great question. Then there's this other one. Imagine yourself as a drop of rainwater that falls on your roof and begins its journey to the ocean. By what network of ditches, creeks, and rivers would you travel? Why is it so important, Stephen, to be able to ask, and even if we don't know the answers, to ask those questions about where we live?
What I advocate in the book is getting your kids on what I call eye-to-eye level with nature. I'm going to stray from your question just to set this up a little bit. Like, I think there are two risks in how kids view themselves in connection to nature. Is that the obvious risk is that you look down on it. It's gross, it's icky, right? And this leads down the road to an attitude about the environment where you're not a caregiver. The other risk is you look up at it, that you have this idea that once humans step foot into nature becomes soiled or spoiled, right? And that it's best observed out a window. And we're the ones that are icky and inherently evil and destructive, and we have no place in nature. What I push for is for kids to just view themselves as being part of it. And part of them being part of it is just understanding what it is and that it's ever present. And it's so obvious, right, that you live at an elevation. But just start imagining them to imagine their home as a habitat. Their home is an ecosystem where they exist. And where does it sit, right? When when rain falls in our yard, by what path does it take to the ocean? And you start to position yourself, not just like geopolitically, but you position yourself as being a functioning member of your environment.
Stephen Ranella is our guest today, and we're talking about his new book, Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, Getting Your Family Out of the House and Radically Engaged with Nature. We'll hear a lot more from Stephen on things to do to get that engagement when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Stephen Ranella is our guest today. He's host of the Netflix series Meat Eater and the Meat Eater podcast as well. And he has a new book out. It's called Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, Getting Your Family Out of the House and Radically Engaged with Nature. And we've been talking about some of the things you can do without even leaving your home, really, to become more engaged with your home habitat, as Stephen just said he called it. And I want to read a couple more of these great questions. He recommends everyone just ask, with along with your kids or if you're a caregiver, anyone in your family or your home environment, you know, ask yourself, where does your water come from? What's the dominant wind direction where you live? What kind of trees are closest to your home? What kind of birds visit your home habitat? Again, just taking a look at home as a habitat itself to get more involved with and understand. So, Stephen, hang on here for another minute, because the reason why I'm focusing on what people can do just outside of their own homes is because many people that live in urban environments or even some suburban environments, that may be the best access they have because... You know, unlike folks who are lucky enough to live within the stone's throw of mountains or a lake or a field full of wildflowers, millions and millions of Americans live in places where the terrain is more vertical, let me put it that way. Vertical in the sense of concrete and asphalt, like, say, New York.
We have our own community garden. It's called the Health for Youth Skyline Community Garden. It's in lovely Staten Island, New York. And that community garden is an old bocce court, and we converted it. And now that community garden serves people throughout Staten Island.
Well, that's Heather Butts. She's co-founder of the nonprofit Health Education Academic Life Skills Training and Help for Youths, also known as Health for Youths for short. She's a professor of public health at Long Island University and Columbia University as well. Now, Health for Youths works with about 5,000 students per year in a number of programs, including that community garden.
When you walk up to the garden is actually situated in a playground. It sits at its highest point at over 200 feet above sea level. And when you look out, you can actually see the New York City skyline. When you walk up to it, it does look like a bocce court at first. So if you've never seen a bocce court before, bocce courts actually look like one very large kind of garden bed to me. And so in it, we have 15 garden boxes. And within them, we're growing things like spinach and carrots. And we have some perennial plants. We have some native plants.
Now, students come from neighborhoods across New York, and they come to the program for a variety of reasons. So how has Professor Butts noticed the way the experiences in the garden shape the students?
That is very much predicated on their own experiences and where they come from and why they're coming to the garden. We saw this keenly when we were doing work in the New York Restoration Project gardens, and we were working with groups of students that were court involved and students that maybe had aged out from foster care. For young people who are coming to the garden and they're going through a difficult time at home, or they're having some challenges or challenges at school, gardens are usually pretty quiet. They're pretty quiet spaces. And the ability to be able to sit in a garden and be with your own thoughts and just sort of think is something that I think we give not enough credit to.
And finally, Professor Butts shared one story of a student she worked with many years ago who was having a tough time at school.
And the student just said to me, my grades are so awful, like I'm not going to get a job and I'm not going to get into college. You know, that's it for me. And so I said to the student, well, I can understand that you feel that way. But first of all, I wouldn't spend the time that I'm spending giving back to you and interacting with you and working with you if I felt that way. And also, you've got a ton of life in front of you. Student went on to have A's and B's, got into college. That one always sticks with me, though, because it was a quiet moment in a garden where we were just reading and about to plant something that conversation happened. It's harder for those conversations to happen if you got a lot going on and you're concentrating on 50 million other things. But in a quiet moment in a garden, you know, with their friends and peers around, student felt open enough to be able to have that conversation. And that to me is sort of the essence and beauty of these open spaces. They can be places where you can play soccer or build little free libraries or do any of that, but they can also be for quiet moments where you can sit and have a conversation with somebody that can hopefully help you reflect on who you are and where you're going.
That's Heather Butts, co-founder of the nonprofit Health for Youths in New York. She also teaches public health at Long Island University and Columbia University as well. Now, Stephen Ranella, in your book, Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, you've got a whole chapter on tending the soil, on gardening. Tell me why.
I grew up gardening. I've always, all through college and graduate school, I mean, no matter where I lived, I always found some way to create a garden. So personally, I like it. And to me, that's actually a big part of getting kids involved in nature is I like nature. I like to be outside and I can demonstrate. And so I like to bring my kids into an arena where I can demonstrate to them enthusiasm, right? I can demonstrate to them some level of expertise. So by getting my kids outside, I'm also serving myself in a way because that's where I like to be. And I can show them things that excite me, and I want them to be around people who are excited by what's going on. The other thing about gardening, though, is I think there's two primary lessons I like to put out to my kids around gardening, is that neglect is deadly, right? Mm-hmm. And things and we nurture things we love, and our nurturing and our love for things that's reflected back to us, right? And what better way to see that in gardening? Also, it brings things that might that living inside in such like opulent comfort as we do in America, meaning we have heated homes and generally have access to food and things, it brings alive these things that that are at risk of becoming abstract, where the weather means something. When you're watching a garden, the weather means something. There are impacts, like climate change will mean something. What better way to demonstrate that than to have flooding and drought, and then also that you're planning all the time, right? You're being adaptable. We're trying, the goal here is that we'll raise some things we like to eat. This is very tricky because we need to find a way to play along with nature in a respectful way. But there's going to be a push and pull. If we're going to be deprived of rain, we're going to find a way to deliver water here. If there's too much sun, we're going to find a way to go against it. And so just every day they're living it. And the frustrating part is there's no way to measure your impact, right? Like you do all these things. There's no way to sort of like download something and be like, oh, wow, in their brain, I'm affecting it this and this way. And I've, you don't know it. It's like by gut, right? But I just have this feeling that I rely on this faith that by having a daily discussions about what's happening around us, and then being able to observe it in plants that we grow throughout the summer growing season, they are taking away these lessons. At a minimum, it would be this. Food does not, in some cases it does, but food does not fall from trees, meaning the things we eat and what supports us takes expertise and effort. And it's not to be taken for granted. And I feel as though I make progress there, though I can't prove it to you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean, because it's sort of viscerally different to watch tomatoes grow and not get like that perfect supermarket supermarket tomato off the plant that you're growing, and trying to understand why and realizing it was hard work to even get, like, I don't know, last year we had some very sorry looking yellow cherry tomatoes, which didn't really grow very well, but they tasted amazing. But so I completely hear what you're saying. You know, there's so many things that you've said about what kids can gain from this engagement. It's not just being outside. It's not that. It's engaging with nature in different ways. Now, there's been a lot of research that's gone into this in the past several years. I'm wondering what you think, Stephen, and you wrote about this in the book, sort of mentally, physically, what are the like one or two of the most important things that kids can uniquely benefit from by engaging with nature?
I had a friendly debate with my publisher where I was using, we're talking about the cover, like the cover copy for the book or whatever. And I was using a word like to make your kids tough. And that means different things to different people. And someone brought up like, is this still are people comfortable with this word? Is this still a thing? I'm like, I'm very comfortable with that word. When I say tough, I don't mean the playground bully. When I say tough, I mean like some resilience to discomfort, right? An ability to be out and realize that in outside you have wild temperature swings. You find times when you're hot. You find times when you're cold. You find times when you're wet. You find times where you spend hours and hours and your socks and shoes are soaked. A toughness like a fortitude. Beyond that, I think there's benefits of self-sufficiency. Just learning how to do things with your hands, right? Like how to make things, whether you're making forts or growing a garden, that you can physically do things with your hands. Long-term, it would be, when I think of the environmental challenges that face us in the future, I feel, and I know this because I study conservation history in the U.S. just as a citizen, I study it, not as an academic. You find that our great conservation heroes tend to be people who had a radical engagement with nature. That involvement breeds a sense that breeds in people a sense of obligation to the planet and a sense of obligation to the natural world around them. If I want my kids to become conservationists, I don't know that they'll become conservation heroes, but we can all dream, right? Mm-hmm. It will be because they learn to love a thing. And from that love came a sense of obligation to it, where they're willing to sacrifice on its behalf. That's the long-term play, right? And I might not hit all of those things, but by doing this, I'm hoping to hit some. And if I could hit one, it would be that.
Yeah,
that they have a obligation to honor and respect the natural world around them and to take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, The other thing that I think comes from pursuing or trying to pursue this engagement with nature is that it's not only just good for the kids, for all the reasons that you just talked about, Stephen, but it's great for the whole family, right? So we spoke with Jose Gonzalez. He's the founder and former executive director of Latino Outdoors. That's an organization whose goal is to engage Latino communities with the outdoors. And he just shared a quick story with us, a conversation from one of his trips with the family he was working with.
The young daughter was sharing with her grandmother the excitement of looking at the flowers, and the kid could recall some stuff from class. They're like, in class, we learned that this, this, and this, and this. And then the grandma also kind of sharing, and here's how I am familiar with this plant because of her heritage and ancestral knowledge of this is how this is medicinal or herbal in these ways. So that was just a great reminder that there was something everyone can contribute and to also support that familial connection.
So that was Jose Gonzalez, founder of Latino Outdoors. And that brought to mind, Stephen, in fact, one of the stories you started us off with about the connections you were making with your kids on that very unexpected outcome to that camping trip in Yellowstone. So listen, we've got 2 minutes left here. And I have been, over the course of this hour, writing down a couple of notes here that I'm going to call Stephen Ranella's, tips for how to get radically engaged. There's many more in the book, but you have no matter what, go. Try to see eye to eye with nature, no matter where it is. Imagine your home, your own home as a habitat, because it is. Grow something. Those are just a few of the notes that I've taken here. In the last minute or minute and a half that we have, what else would you recommend, Stephen, that people ought to do, no matter where they live, even if they live like right next to a lake like you did growing up, or if they live, you know, on the 30th floor of a building in the middle of one of America's big cities? What should families do to get more radically engaged?
I'm going to get very specific and tell you one that we found that I found with my own kids to be very effective, as we keep a list of all birds either seen or heard from our home habitat, right? So you have to see it or hear it from our yard. And our list has grown to impressive lengths. And to help you with this, I'll point out there's a new app out called Merlin, which is from the Cornell Ornithology Lab. And it's wonderful. And you can turn it on and it will listen to the bird songs in your area and start to list out what birds you might have around. And then you got to try to find them, right? And match to them. But our kids get so excited about opening up. We have a Google Drive folder and we open that up and add a bird. And when we're able to add a bird, it is they view it as a great achievement, and it's a lot of fun.
Amazing. Well, Stephen Ranella, in the book, you also talk about sleeping outdoors, about foraging. So we just got to the surface of all the great advice and stories that are in Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, getting your family out of the house and radically engaged with nature. That's Stephen's new book. And Stephen Ranella, it's been such a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Stephen was in Bozeman, Montana. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.